it just didn't feel real. It felt like it was, you know, crazy. And the whole dynamic of the courtroom, where the prosecutor was able to speak freely, my lawyer was able to speak freely, the judge, everybody was allowed to speak freely except for me.
In January 1991, 17-year-old Jeffrey Deskovic was standing in court next to his attorney, facing a judge, after having been convicted of a horrible crime he knew he didn't commit. When it was finally his turn to speak, after a trial in which his attorney wouldn't listen to his suggestions, in which the prosecutor told the jury he did unthinkable things to a fellow classmate, and in which he had to listen as police officers recounted a confession he felt he had been forced to give, he addressed the court. "I didn't do anything," he said. "I've already had a year of my life taken from me for something I didn't do, and I'm about to lose more time and I didn't do anything." But it seemed no one was listening. On November 17th, 1989, one of Jeff's high school classmates went missing. Her body was found 2 days later in a wooded area. She had been raped, strangled, and beaten. 2 months later, in January 1990, Jeff was arrested and charged with murder. And despite there having been no physical evidence or eyewitness testimony to connect him to the crime, he was ultimately convicted.
I couldn't believe my own ears. I mean, the first three charges that they read off, I was found not guilty of, and my mother, you know, started cheering in the court like you might at some kind of a sporting event. And then all of a sudden I heard, you know, guilty, and I couldn't believe my own ears. And I remember just feeling really frightened and, you know, not knowing what was gonna happen next.
At his sentencing, the judge called the case a classic tragedy and said that two young people's lives were now destroyed. He said he had observed Jeff more closely than any other defendant and said that he recognized the support he was getting from his family. He then acknowledged that maybe Jeff was innocent, but that the jury had spoken and the court could neither quarrel or disagree with the verdict. He imposed the minimum sentence of 15 years to life in prison. "I will be back on appeal," Jeff said as the hearing came to a close. "Justice will yet be served. I will be set free." This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 123. With everything going on right now, a lot of people are asking if it's even possible to buy life insurance at all. The answer is yes. It's still easy to shop for life insurance right now. And if you have loved ones depending on your income, you probably should. Right now, you could save $1,500 or more a year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. When you're shopping for a policy that could last for a decade or more, those savings really start to add up. What is Policy Genius? It's an insurance marketplace built and backed by a team of industry experts. Here's how it works. Step one, head on over to policygenius.com. In minutes, you can work out how much coverage you need and compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price. Step two, apply for your lowest price. Step three, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and red tape. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance company. So if you hit any speed bumps during the application process, they'll take care of everything. They even have policies which allow eligible customers to skip the in-person medical exam and do it over the phone. That kind of service has earned Policy Genius a 5-star rating across over 1,600 reviews on Trustpilot and Google. So if you need life insurance, head to policygenius.com right now to get started. You could save $1,500 or more a year by comparing quotes on their marketplace. Policy Genius, when it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. America might be ready to get back to work, but to win in the new economy, you need every advantage to succeed. Smart companies run on NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. With NetSuite, you'll have visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more. Everything you need, all in one place. Whether you're doing a million or hundreds of millions in sales, NetSuite lets you manage every penny with precision. You'll have the ability to compete with anyone, work from anywhere, and run your whole company right from your phone. Join over 20,000 companies who trust NetSuite to make it happen. NetSuite surveyed hundreds of business leaders and assembled a playbook of the top strategies they're using as America reopens for business. Receive your free guide, 7 Actions Businesses Need to Take Now, and schedule your free product tour at netsuite.com/court. Get your free guide and schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/court. That's netsuite.com/court. In November 1989, Jeff Deskovic was a 16-year-old sophomore at Peekskill High School in Peekskill, New York.
I grew up in Peekskill, which is a suburb of Westchester, which was middle class and ethnically diverse. I would say in my high school years, I kind of lived a double life in the sense that after school, in the apartment complex that I grew up at and in the surrounding neighborhoods, I was pretty popular. There was a lot of kids there, and pretty much whatever I said would be what we would do, whether that was swimming or kickball or Monopoly or go ride a bike or basketball, et cetera. But in high school, that was a different group of kids that were older than a little bit older than me, and I never quite fit in there. And so I was kind of like a recluse. I was quiet, withdrawn, tight.
Jeff lived in a 3-bedroom apartment with his mom, younger brother, grandmother, and at one point, 5 cats and a fish tank. He never knew his father growing up. He had left his mom long before Jeff was even born. Peekskill was a relatively safe neighborhood. As long as Jeff had been alive, there had never been any murders there. But on November 15th, 1989, a newfound sense of panic came over the community after 15-year-old Angela Correa, also a sophomore at Peekskill High School, went missing. An announcement was made over the school's PA system that Angela was missing and that if anyone had any information about her disappearance, to go to the principal's office.
It really shook up the whole community. I mean, there had been a bunch of safety protocols that had been implemented. For example, the school emphasized that there should be a buddy system. You shouldn't go anywhere by yourself and, you know, make sure, you know, your parents know where you're going and what you're doing.
Angela had last been seen on the afternoon of November 15th. According to court records, she left school at about 2:45 p.m., went home, and changed into casual clothes. She then left home, carrying a camera and telephoto lens in a plastic bag. She wore a Walkman-type cassette player and headphones, with a New Kids on the Block cassette inside. She was reported missing by her family the next day. A witness who had seen Angela said he was taking his daily walk through Hillcrest Park, and he saw her at approximately 3:30 p.m. He recounted hearing voices which sounded like arguing, but he couldn't make out what was said. Then, 2 days later, on November 17th, Angela's body was found in a wooded area in Hillcrest Park. She was covered with leaves, mostly naked, with her clothing nearby. Underneath her body was a piece of a torn, wet note that Angela had written to a classmate named Freddie. It was dated November 15th. Jeff recalled reading about Angela's body having been found in Westchester's daily newspaper.
I was very surprised. I was kind of stunned as well. I remember having saw her in class a few days before that, you know, and that was, you know, also kind of like my first real brush with death. I thought that was, you know, something that happened to people after they, you know, lived a whole life and were rather old.
According to Angela's autopsy, the cause of her death was a fractured skull, internal hemorrhage, and asphyxiation due to ligature strangulation. She had numerous bruises and cuts all over her body, as though she had been dragged face down through the dirt. There were also definitive signs that she had been raped. The medical examiner estimated her time of death as between 3:30 p.m. and 4:30 p.m. on the day she disappeared.
after a body was found, there were a lot of town hall type meetings, you know, to discuss progress on the investigation. And, you know, there was a general atmosphere of paranoia, of fear, rumor. So it really had everybody's attention. I mean, the whole city almost shut down. I mean, parents were coming, driving right to the high school to pick their kids up and bring them straight home.
The lead detectives on the case were detectives Thomas McIntyre and David Levine. They interviewed Angela's classmates, and while the investigation was going on, naturally for a small town, rumors about what happened were circulating at school.
Well, there were rumors flying around. I mean, I think that there had been, just outside of Peekskill, there had been a popular arcade that rumor had it that a body was found there, and that was just outside, technically outside of Peekskill. So one rumor was that perpetrator had gotten released and, you know, he had committed the crime. So that was a rumor. In terms of Freddie, I wouldn't say anyone in the community looked at him as a suspect, but it's clear that the police did.
Investigators definitely did look at Freddie Claxton, another one of Angela's classmates, as a suspect early on, but he had an alibi and was soon cleared. And they soon set their eyes on another suspect, someone they believed was oddly overly upset about Angela's murder, someone they would later say other classmates had suggested they talk to, someone who didn't fit in at school. That someone also matched a profile of the offender put forth by the NYPD. That someone was Jeff Deskovic. On December 12th, 1989, Jeff was on his way to school when he was intercepted by the plainclothes detectives.
I mean, I lived across the street from the high school. It was the high school was just up on it, a little bit on a hill. You could actually see it. So there was only like two different routes to get to the high school from where I lived. And it wasn't hard to figure out which route I would take. So the police were waiting for me halfway up the hill. And they stepped out of the car when they saw me and they called my name. They were in plain clothes and they called my name. And I was leery of talking to them because that was another one of the safety protocols. You know, don't talk to strangers, don't get in a car with anyone that you don't know. So at some point, they convinced me that they actually were police officers. It was the fact that they had a radio inside the car. I mean, I still wasn't convinced even when they showed me their ID. And they told me that they wanted me to help them out in the case. And I told them that I didn't know anything about it, so I didn't see how I could be helpful. But they told me they wanted me to come to the police station anyway to be helpful. So, you know, at some point they prevailed upon me and I went.
At first, the interview started out cordially, much like a potential witness interview. But then it would switch and Jeff was made very aware that they were now looking at him as a possible suspect. He said they played that good cop, bad cop routine you hear about in the movies and on TV shows, where one cop acts like he's your friend and savior, while the other is aggressive and even mean. But they also employed another tactic, one which really seemed to resonate with Jeff. They made it seem as though they wanted his help in solving the crime.
They would say things like, the kids won't talk freely around us, but they will around you. Let us know if you hear any rumors. Stop in from time to time. They would ask me opinion questions and congratulate me if my opinions were correct. They made me feel important. They made me feel as I was in the center of attention. Before I was a teenager, I wanted to be a cop. So this early, unexpected opportunity to do this quasi-police work was how, along with my age, being 16, they were able to rope me in. And secondly, just the fact that my father was never involved in my life. That was a factor that intersected with the good cop, bad cop technique where one officer was pretending to be my friend. You know, in other words, the other one was aggressive. And I began to look up to the officer who was pretending to be my friend as a father figure.
Jeff met with the detectives multiple times over the next several weeks, even over his mother's objections, who, perhaps with her age and wisdom, realized that her son was a suspect, that he was only 16. Something Jeff knew, but didn't seem to really grasp the implications of.
I knew that my mother did not want me to talk to him, so I told my mother about the first time I interacted with the police, and she brought me to see a lawyer, and the lawyer told me don't speak with the police, and that my mother didn't want me to speak to them either, but I didn't really understand why not. I mean, on top of that, I was 16 years old, and that's a typical age where kids are looking for their own autonomy, and there's a rebellion against authority, and of course, we all know better and our parents are stupid. And, I kind of shared that thought at the time. So that was part of it. And, and then as a result of that, at times things were combative with my mother just in general. And that all of that contributed to my not sharing with my mother or my brother or anybody really what was going on between the police and I.
Jeff visited the crime scene a couple times and would go to the detectives with any rumors he heard at school. They would periodically ask him to take a polygraph test, which he initially declined.
Eventually, they got me to agree to the test by telling me that there was some new information that had come in and they wanted to share that with me, and that would allow me to be even more helpful to them. But I would have to take and pass the polygraph first. And then they also told me that if I took and passed the polygraph that they would stop talking to me like if I was a suspect. Because again, half the conversation was they'd talk to me as if I was a suspect. And then when they would push too hard, I would become frightened. That's when they would switch it up. And Jeff as the junior detective helpful theme was what would be rolled out. And so they kept me off balance that way. But they said that if I passed that polygraph, they could cease that part of the interactive dynamic.
On January 25th, 1990, at about 9:30 a.m., Jeff went to the police station, where he had been meeting with detectives for weeks now, to take the polygraph test. But instead of administering the test there, like he had heard they had done with other suspects in the case, they drove him 40 minutes away, across county lines, to Brewster, New York. Jeff was by himself. He hadn't told his mom or brother that he was coming, and he hadn't thought to have an attorney accompany him. And now, he had no idea where he even was, and no ride to get home if he decided he wanted to leave. Jeff was given a polygraph, and they continued questioning him.
And then they put me in a small room, and the polygraphist gave me countless cups of coffee in order to get me, it seems clear that he did that in order to get me nervous. And then he attached the machine to me, so now I really couldn't. Yeah, I was fairly immobile. I mean, I could stand up, but that was pretty much it. And then he did his third-degree tactic. So he invaded my personal space. He raised his voice at me. He kept asking me the same questions over and over again. As each hour passed, my fear increased in proportion to the time. At one point, he said to me at the end, he said, what do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the polygraph test result that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it. And that really shot my fear through the roof. And at that point, the officer who had been pretending to be my friend, he came in the room and he told me that the other officers were going to harm me, but that he had been holding them off but could not do so any longer, that I had to help myself. Then he added, if I did as they wanted, they'd stop what they're doing and I could go home afterwards and I was not going to be arrested. So being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, not thinking about the long term, I was instead just concerned my safety at the moment. Plus, I was in fear of my life. The fact that I didn't know where I was, that nobody else knew where I was either, it loomed very large in my mind. And there was that push-pull dynamic of, on one hand, the possibility of harm had been thrown in the air, and on the other, he had thrown me this false life preserver. So I took the out which they offered, and I made up a story based upon the information which they had given me in the course of the interrogation that day and in the 6 weeks run up to it, as well as items from the newspaper. By the time the interrogation was finished, I had collapsed on the floor into a fetal position and was crying uncontrollably.
The confession was not recorded on audio or video, nor was it written down. Afterwards, they drove him back to the police headquarters in Peekskill. But what he didn't know was that he wasn't free to go home.
I was eating pizza that they had given me, and I still didn't realize what was going on, and I was interrupted periodically by different officers carrying out various aspects of the processing. And so finally, they did the fingerprints and printing, which, you know, resulted in my having ink on my fingers. And I remember being angry about that, and I looked for the detectives, and I saw one of them who had been the bed cop, and I, you know, asked him, why is he doing that? I've got ink on my fingers now. I'm trying to eat pizza. And the detective said, he has a right to do that. And I said, what do you mean he has a right to do that? I was told that I wasn't going to be arrested. And he said, you are being charged with the crime.
Jeff said he was angry and felt that he had been lied to by the nice cop, the one he had been starting to look at as almost a father figure. Beyond that, he was afraid and didn't know what to think. They called his mom and she came to the station and spoke to him from behind glass. He said he had no idea what was going to happen to him next. He never could have expected that what was happening to him would happen.
Never. I thought it was a waste of time, and I thought it was kind of crazy that they were even talking to me that way, because, you know, I knew I was innocent. So I never thought about the idea that I could be arrested for something I didn't do.
Jeff made bail after spending 35 days in jail. A local business owner put up the money and received backlash in the community for doing so. By that time, with the exception of his family, most people believed that he was guilty. None of his friends were allowed to talk to him anymore, and he was isolated from the life he had once had. Soon thereafter, he made a suicide attempt. He took an entire bottle of extra-strength Tylenol and went to sleep.
In 10 hours, I felt like my life was over. I mean, I was hated throughout the city. I couldn't go back to my old life. I mean, as I mentioned, I was hated throughout the city. I couldn't go back to school. My case was pending. You know, none of the parents of the other kids I used to play with were willing to let them play with me. So I felt like my life was in effect over. So I made a suicide attempt, and that resulted in my being involuntarily committed for 6 months.
Jeff spent the next 6 months at the Rockland Children's Psychiatric Hospital. When he was released from there, he went to live with his aunt and uncle in a different county. Leading up to his trial, his attorney, a public defender, rarely met with him. When they did meet, Jeff would tell him that he was actually innocent, that his confession had been coerced and that it wasn't true. But the attorney didn't seem to care about any of that. One time, his attorney told him that he didn't care if he was guilty or innocent. At one point, his attorney said he wanted to use an insanity defense, to which Jeff was adamantly against.
I told him, no, I'm innocent. I didn't do this. An insanity defense gives a reason why you did commit the crime, and I didn't commit the crime.
Jeff also had an alibi. He had been playing wiffle ball with a friend of his at the time of the murder, but his attorney never interviewed that friend. As for the alleged confession, Jeff had told his attorney that he wanted to testify about how that happened during a pretrial hearing. He knew that it had been coerced and that it was false. But his attorney wouldn't let him, saying that if he planned on testifying at trial, he didn't want him testifying prior to that. He gave the reason that no one ever tells the same story in the same way, and if there were any differences in his testimonies, the prosecutor could use that against him. Being just 16 years old and believing that his attorney knew best, Jeff didn't testify at the hearing. Less than 2 months after Jeff's arrest, the results of the swabbings of semen from Angela's vaginal cavity were back from the FBI crime lab. Jeff was excluded as the source. There were also 3 different head hairs found on Angela's body that were also not a match to Jeff. But still, Jeff went to trial in November 1990.
I was mostly dreading it because I knew that this coerced confession was going to come up. And, you know, it had me pretty despondent and pretty depressed. And I kind of realized what had happened. And I thought that I was going to be you know, I thought that I was probably, I thought I was going to lose the case, and that that's what had, you know, had me depressed and ultimately making a suicide attempt. But in time, through statements from my immediate and extended family, you know, that expressed trust and confidence in the system, and they felt that everything was going to come out okay. So at some point, I began to believe that I was going to be acquitted at the trial. I was going to be found not guilty.
In his opening statements, the prosecutor told the jury that this case did have some twists and wrinkles. He acknowledged that the semen found in Angela had not come from Jeff, but he wrote it off as either coming from an accomplice or from a consensual sexual encounter he said Angela must have had prior to her death with Freddie, although prosecutors never compared it to Freddie's DNA or made any efforts to compare it with anyone else. And as for the head hairs, the prosecutor told the jury that they were from the medical examiner or the medical examiner's assistant, although prosecutors didn't seek hair samples from them to corroborate that theory either. But Jeff did match their offender profile they had obtained from the NYPD, that the killer was a white or Hispanic male, less than 25 years old, and probably less than 19 years old, who was shorter than 5'10". According to the profile, the offender knew Angela and was a loner who was unsure about women. And Jeff had confessed, even though there was no record of it. The prosecutor told the jury that during detectives' interviews with Jeff, he knew things about the murder that only the killer could know, among them the details of the crime scene and the existence of the note to Freddie. Jeff said he had only been repeating back what detectives had first told him and what he had read in the newspaper. As for Jeff's defense, well, there really wasn't much of one. His attorney didn't try to confirm his alibi, didn't talk to the jury about how Jeff may have been vulnerable to a coerced confession, and he didn't harp on the fact that the scientific evidence actually excluded him. He made no efforts to question Freddie or to get Freddie's DNA himself to see if the semen found on Angela really was from a consensual sexual encounter prior to her death, or if it perhaps came from someone else, like the real killer. He was also all over the place with his explanations of the evidence to the jury.
At times, he was arguing to the jury that the, you know, that the confession didn't happen at all. At other times, he was arguing that it happened, but it was coerced and false. So he took this scattershot approach, which, you know, could not have left him with very much credibility in front of the jury.
On yet another occasion, Jeff's attorney told the jury that the statements Jeff made were involuntary and that it didn't matter if they were true. At one point, he said Jeff knew things about the crime because he had heard rumors or had even imagined them. While at another point, he said Jeff may have actually witnessed the crime and gained his knowledge that way. And as far as Jeff testifying in his own defense, well, that didn't happen either. His attorney strongly advised him not to.
The only thing I had was just to trust him, and he was saying that to me, you know, and then his argument was, well, you didn't listen to adults before, not to speak to the police and look at the trouble you got into. You don't want to make that same kind of mistake now. Look, kid, I'm the lawyer. You're not. Just sit back and let me do the job. Let me do my job.
Just before closing arguments began, prosecutors announced that four of their exhibits, which included some of the clothes Angela had been wearing, had been lost during Thanksgiving break. The defense moved for a mistrial, but it was denied. The significance of this was that during Jeff's confession, he had said he ripped off Angela's bra during the attack. Jeff's defense had planned to argue that this would have been impossible, given that her bra was a pullover with no snaps or clips. But without the physical exhibit, they decided to forego that argument. During their deliberations, the jury asked to view the bra, but the court told them that it could not comply with their request. Jeff was shocked when the guilty verdict was read, and after he was escorted from the courtroom after sentencing to start his life in prison. Because he had been tried as an adult, he was sent to a men's maximum security prison. He was just 17 years old. Nowadays, coloring your hair in the comfort of your own home sounds pretty great. But I know you're likely wondering how you would find the right color and what about the price? Well, Madison Reed makes coloring your hair at home affordable, and they give you the tools you need to choose your perfect color. It wasn't too long ago when you only had two options for coloring your hair. You could either try outdated at-home color or spend time and money at a salon. Well, now, Madison Reed takes coloring your hair at home to the next level and gives you beautiful, professional hair color delivered right to your door, starting at just $22. What makes Madison Reed's color unique is that it's crafted by master colorists who blend nuances of light, dark, cool, and warm tones to create over 55 gorgeous multidimensional shades. And don't worry, finding the perfect shade is easy. You just go to their website, madison-reed.com, and take their quiz that asks you things like what you want your end result to be, what your hair texture is, etc. And voila, they match you with your perfect shade. So do your hair coloring at home and look as if you just came from the salon. Now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on their first color kit by using the code COURT. Go to madison-reed.com and use the code COURT. That's madison-reed.com and use the code COURT.
I remember, well, first of all, being on the bus. I mean, I remember being in handcuffs and having my legs fastened together and being fastened to the legs of the person on the bus next to me. And I remember how large the prison wall loomed, how menacing the barbed wire appeared. And I remember as I walked down the cell gallery, I saw a lot of prisoners there whose arms were as big as my legs. So I remember that. And I remember being really frightened. And, you know, just the idea of, you know, being in prison where the guards were in control rather than civilians, because I had been housed in the forensic unit, the mental health ward, the county jail, so where the civilians were in charge. So the idea of being in a place where the guards were in control was a frightening concept for me as well. And half the time that I was there, and I couldn't even believe that I was there because it seemed like so many different things had to happen and go wrong in order to culminate into that result. And the odds of any one of them happening that way, you know, just seemed kind of remote, much less all of them that happened in the aggregate. So I was in that state of disbelief a lot. But I mean, at other times, I mean, I had to fight off feelings of hopelessness, thoughts of giving up, you know, suicidal ideation. And I had to fight all those things.
Jeff was among the youngest inmates in the prison. And to make matters worse, he had been convicted of not only a murder, but a sex offense as well.
And, you know, then I was there not just for a murder, but for a sex offense. And there's a vigilante mentality where people have been convicted of sex offenses. So, you know, I always had in the back of my mind, I mean, I lived in fear that, you know, people would discover what I had been incarcerated for. And that would, you know, that would serve as motivation on their part to assault me. Because there's a vigilante mentality towards people who've been convicted of sex offenses.
Jeff eventually learned to adapt and stayed busy as the years went by. He got his GED, learned to type, completed his associate's degree as well as a year towards his bachelor's degree before funding was cut. He participated in programs like computer repair, general business, plumbing, and painting. He worked as a teacher's aide in the prison for about a year and a half. He was trying to prepare for what he would do if and when he was released. He also played a lot of sports, basketball, ping pong, and chess.
I engaged in this elaborate delusion when I was playing, like if I was a professional player and so were the other people and people on the sidelines waiting for next game, that those were the fans. And one recreational area was like for like a home game. Another area was like for an away game. But it was not really like kids fantasizing about playing professional, you know, sports as kids. I mean, this was more of a defense mechanism where, you know, I needed to leave the prison for a couple of hours just mentally.
He would pretend that instead of going to his prison assignment in the morning or afternoon, he was going to work or school. It wasn't the warden at the prison, but the superintendent at school. He would cut out pictures of nature scenes and hang them on his cell walls so he would wake up seeing them and could travel there mentally. In terms of friendships, One person he bonded with was a man named Frank Sterling. They had strikingly similar cases and would get together and brainstorm about how they could each prove their innocence. He kept his mind occupied and tried to avoid the riffraff and not get caught up in prison politics. He read 3 to 4 nonfiction books a week at one point, and after he went through the entire prison library, one of the guards would bring him books from the outside to read. And he went to the law library a lot. He was determined to try and overturn his conviction and regain his freedom. He would look up cases and send ideas to different attorneys. After his experience with his trial attorney, he knew he didn't trust an attorney to work on the case by themselves. He knew he had to have a big part in it now. After his appeals were exhausted, he wrote a letter that was eventually forwarded to an investigator, who wrote him back right away. When he told her how the DNA in his case had excluded him, she was convinced of his innocence. She worked with him for the next year, searching for attorneys who would take his case pro bono. She suggested he reach out to the Innocence Project again. He had reached out years earlier with no response. But this time, with the help of the investigator, he did get a response, and they decided to take on his case. It was the year 2006. By this time, Jeanine Pierrot had left the DA's office. As DA, Pierrot had fought against Jeff's multiple requests to have the DNA from Angela's body put into CODIS, an ever-growing databank, to see if there were any hits. Now there was a new DA, Janet DeFiore, and she promptly met with Barry Scheck from the Innocence Project and agreed to the testing. While they were awaiting the results, one day Nina Morrison, Jeff's other attorney at the Innocence Project, came to see him. He had been in prison now for 16 years.
I had been transferred about to Sing Sing prison. I had been transferred there. I'd been in the prison for about 27 days there. And she came up to see me and she told me that the items had been tested. And I said, what are you talking about? They're not supposed to be tested for another month. And she said, yeah, no, they've been... DA got the lab to test the items quicker. And then she said the results matched somebody else that, you're going home tomorrow.
The crime lab reported that the unknown DNA profile had made a match. It matched the DNA profile of Stephen Cunningham, who was serving a life sentence for a murder in Westchester County that took place only a few years after Angela was found dead. Cunningham ended up confessing and ultimately pleaded guilty to Angela's murder. On November 2nd, 2006, the Westchester DA told the court that they were moving to dismiss the indictment because Jeff is actually innocent. The prosecutor added, quote, the most sincere apologies we can muster on behalf of the Westchester County District Attorney's Office and the Peekskill Police. When Jeff initially got the news, he couldn't believe it was happening. Every time an appeal had been filed, he had gotten his hopes up, so he was still skeptical.
For the next 3.5 hours, I just sat there in kind of like a mental paralysis. And, you know, she literally held my hand. And, you know, all these different random thoughts were coming to my head. And I was talking to her about all these different thoughts, and really one thing had nothing to do with the other, and she was just sitting there, and every now and then she would break in and say, are you ready to talk about tomorrow? And I said, no. And, you know, then I would ramble some more, and eventually what made it real was that she said, look, it's almost time for the visit to be over. There's a ton of work that has to be done between now and tomorrow, including getting the media ready, and I have to take your size, your shoe size, and your clothing sizes. You know, items have to be purchased for you. And, that made it more real. You know, but then a different thought, a different fear came in my mind, which was I thought that something was going to happen between that day and the next that was, you know, and the DA was going to change her mind. And, you know, they would do what they always did, which was, you know, fight against me and win.
But that didn't happen. Jeff was finally released from prison after serving 16 years for a crime that he didn't commit. But his homecoming wouldn't be easy. On the day Jeff was released, it was sunny outside, not a cloud in the sky. He walked out of the courtroom to his attorneys from the Innocence Project, along with various law school students clapping for him. They immediately held a press conference outside, and Jeff remembers his first words being, "Is this really happening?" He spoke for over 2 hours, essentially giving a presentation of everything he wanted to say for over the last 16 years, but couldn't. From there, they had a luncheon.
I remember my first meal was Brussels with fried diavolo sauce and side of baked ziti and Neapolitan ice cream. And I remember when I had took a bite of the ice cream, one of the members of the media that was there took a picture of that. And so in that moment, I kind of sort of had a feeling like what it might be like if you were, you know, if I was famous, some paparazzi took a picture of me on a restaurant.
From there, he went to his aunt's house. By then, his mom had long since moved away from Peekskill. As they were sitting around the table, drinking coffee and talking about everything, he said he remembers feeling out of place, like he couldn't properly communicate.
And I'd like to say I had this great party that lasted to the crack of dawn, but the truth was that I had long since lost touch with everybody. I mean, they all had essentially turned on me at the time I was arrested, and, you know, except for the couple of people I mentioned before, but, you know, they weren't allowed to play with me either. So it was, you know, I couldn't relate. I mean, it was very hard for me to communicate. I knew that that all these different thoughts and feelings I had, you know, there was nothing in the background, the people around me to help them understand it. And I remember just feeling out of place. You know, the culture was different. Technology was different. Nothing looked the same anymore.
He felt like he didn't belong on the outside. He knew he didn't belong on the inside either because he didn't do anything, but it was hard for him to shake the feeling. He also had to learn how to do things he had never done before, get a license, balance a checkbook, pay bills, and there was a slew of psychological effects he had to deal with too. In fact, at one point, he almost ended up in a homeless shelter, but Mercy College gave him a scholarship to finish his bachelor's degree. And that allowed him to live on campus. He completed his bachelor's degree, went on to get his master's degree, and then his law degree. 5 years after his release, Jeff finally received compensation from New York State, Westchester County, and Peekskill, as well as from a civil rights lawsuit he filed against Putnam County. From the day he was released, Jeff has become an advocate for those facing wrongful convictions, just like he did. He decided to trade privacy for awareness and started doing television and print interviews. He's met with elected officials to talk about wrongful conviction measures, and he used some of his compensation money to start the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. They have since been able to get 7 people home in 7 years, pass 3 laws, and they currently have 12 active cases. He's also part of a coalition group called It Could Happen to You, and he sits on a Global Advisory Council of Restorative Justice International, where he advises them on wrongful conviction issues. And maybe most surprisingly, he gives presentations in front of police cadets and judges.
That's still surreal to me. Mm-hmm. Every time, the fact that I would be welcomed into a, you know, police academies and speak in front of cadets and give my case as an example, give my story as an example of what can go wrong if they don't do their job correctly. And then, you know, towards the end, I do talk about best practices that they can implement on their own to avoid arresting the wrong person. And so I find that to be very healing and cathartic. And I have this tradition that I take a picture with the class at the end. And, you know, I share that with other people and other presentations when promoting the theme that, you know, fighting wrongful conviction is about fighting for justice. And it's not against the police or the prosecutors. It's against the rogue police, people, police that break the rules. It's against prosecutors who go outside the bounds of what's proper. Yeah, but it's not anti-cop. It's not anti-prosecutor per se. You know, and so, you know, and I point out that every time the wrong person is wrongfully convicted, that the actual perpetrator is free to strike again. And so I try to position the issue that way, and then as a nonpartisan type of thing as well. And I'm accepted into those quarters with those police cadets, and I've done a lot of presentations, maybe like five in front of various gatherings of judges, and whether they asked me to present about one wrongful conviction topic or another, and I've been in front of some groups of prosecutors, and I've done training sessions in front of lawyers, and that's all in addition to making the rounds at colleges, universities, law schools, even high schools, community organizations, and even some international work.
Jeff has now been home for 14 years. 4 years ago, he was invited to attend his high school reunion, even though he was never able to graduate with his class. Much to his surprise, his former classmates welcomed him with open arms. And remember that friend that Jeff made while in prison? Frank Sterling was released and completely exonerated as well in 2010. Unfortunately, he would pass away from a heart attack in 2017. He spent nearly 20 years of his life in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And that's all for this episode. As always, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. A very special thank you to Jeff Deskovic for sharing his story with us. To read more about his case and what he's up to today, visit jeffreydeskovic.com. I'll also include a link to that in the show notes. I'll be releasing a little bonus episode about Jeff's friend, Frank Sterling, who I mentioned was also exonerated, on Patreon for my $10 supporters. If you haven't checked it out yet, I have quite a few tiers on Patreon if you're looking for ways to support the podcast. At the $3 a month level, you get access to regular Court Junkie episodes without all the ads. At $6 a month, you get that plus a monthly bonus episode. And for $10 a month, you get all that plus Court Junkie stickers, a button, and any additional case updates and bonus content, such as the one I'm going to be releasing about Frank Sterling. So to check that out, go to courtjunkie.com/support, which will then redirect you to my Patreon page. But I also want to add that these are some really hard times we're living in, and I don't want anyone to feel pressured to donate. There are tons of other ways to support your favorite podcasts that are immensely helpful, like telling other people about them, leaving positive reviews, and just continuing to listen. All of those things help in more ways than you know. Anyway, that's all for today. Thanks for listening. Until next time.